the top of the IDS Center.
A-F-A-I. And the Lord said, let there be crap.
What's with all the crap?
It's not crap.
It's Crapinfest.
I can't believe it only comes 52 times a year.
Crap from the past.
Crap from the past.
Crap from the past.
Stop! It's hammer time!
Funk, rock, Peter Gabriel singing in German, soul, old school rap, ABBA singing in Spanish, glam, hair metal, Milli Vanilli singing in English, and of course, disco.
Disco is the pop music of tomorrow.
It's all pop, and it's only on Crap from the Past.
Shake your booty. Shake your groove thing. Shake your rump to the funk.
There's a lot of crap on the radio, but there's only one Crap from the Past.
It's craptacular.
Worldwide at crapfromthepast.com and Friday nights at 10:30 on
K-F-A-I.
Now, usually I start with a song, but instead of a song this week, I'm going to start with this little gem that I have here on the hard drive. You may remember this.
If you're ready to dance, here's the music. Come dancing with K-Tel's Dancing Madness. The album's catching on like wildfire. From the fascinating human league to the danceable sounds of musical youth. Motown lives with the Hollies. Marvelous Matumi.
You're right here with me.
Join the Culture Club. Dancing Madness, the best of today's danceable rock with Sparks and Jane Weedlin, OXO and Jeffrey Osborne, A Flock of Seagulls. The music never stops with Naked Eyes. Electrifying Eddie Grant. Catch Dancing Madness. The album's hot, and it's from K-Tel. In stores now.
Yay! All right, then. You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis 106.7 FM, St. Paul, online at KFAI.org and crapfromthepast.com. I'm Ron Boogie Monster Gerber. This is Crap from the Past, beaming out worldwide from KFAI in Minneapolis. It's a graduate-level course in pop, in case you've never heard this show before. We do a lot of pop stuff, and we're in our 21st year of doing Crap from the Past. This week, here in the studio, I'm joined with a gentleman named Mickey Elfenbein. And you may not know the name, but you certainly know the company he worked for. He was at K-Tel Records. Well, K-Tel International?
K-Tel International.
K-Tel International from 1969 to 1996. And you had very strong involvement with all the K-Tel albums that the ones I purchased as a kid and my audience members purchased as a kid. Amazingly influential on all of us. Let's see, just to give you a sense of context, I started listening to the radio in late 78. I was 10. And I started buying 45s in 78. And I would go up to the counter at Caldor. It was a chain out east that doesn't exist anymore. It's a lot like a low-budget Target. And they went out of business along with a whole lot of other chains that aren't around anymore. But at the same time that I was buying 45s, I noticed for just a couple bucks more, I could get this big album with a whole lot of songs on it, usually 16, 18, 14 songs on it, and hits, either songs that were about to be hits or songs that had recently been hits or songs that were on the radio right now. I got to get these. That'll save me some money in the long term. And I bought two or three at the time, and I showed you one or two of them. The ones from late 79, or late 78, early 79 were the first ones I bought. And I kept buying them periodically throughout the 80s. I bought 45s all throughout high school. And once I hit college, CDs were the thing, and I got my first CD player in 88 and took off after that. And now I have a basement full of music, just like a lot of my listeners, and probably you as well?
Yes, sure.
Did you were you a music fan when you first started at the company?
Not really a music fan. I was more of a, you know, business marketing kind of guy.
Okay. Well, and so K-Tel started in 1969. Can you tell me a little bit about how the company gelled? How did it get
together? Well, actually, K-Tel started before that in Canada, and some of the predecessor companies actually were in Canada and in the Eastern United States and in the United States under different names. In 1972, they were all brought under one umbrella called K-Tel.
Okay.
K for Kivas, which was the family owned predominance of the company, and Tel for television.
Oh, really? Oh, so, okay, I'd never heard that before. So television marketing was integral right from the start?
Absolutely.
Okay. So for those who have never seen the commercials and don't remember what that would have been like, talk a little bit about how a product would get rolled out and then introduced on TV in some of the ads.
Well, if it was a music product, we would have to commit to the album in up front. We'd go out and license the album. We'd create an album jacket. We would manufacture potentially hundreds of thousands of units and ship them into stores. We would have bought television advertising in advance of that. And all of a sudden, one day, we would hit the airwaves and radio with television and radio promoting the albums that were available in retail stores all across the country.
So they were pretty much rolled out at the same time the television ads hit the air.
Okay. Yeah, they was all simultaneous. There were sometimes we would do an album in a regional sometimes, but for our big albums, it was national rollout all pretty much on the same day.
Okay. Early on, so the actual albums, the first albums I remember seeing were around 69, 70, 71, that time frame?
Yeah, the first albums were around 1970, right? Okay. The first albums were 1970. The first album in the United States was an album called 25 Polka Greats.
With 25 songs crammed onto an album.
And that was an album that we started out in Canada, actually. Didn't know if it was going to sell in the United States, and we wound up testing it market to market, and wound up selling, you know, over a million units. There were markets like Milwaukee and Chicago where some stores were selling 1,000 units. In that those days, it was vinyl, of course, selling 1,000 units a week in a Montgomery Ward store.
Were your records sold differently than the major label albums?
They were, because we shipped everybody on a direct basis. A lot of the major label albums were sold, sometimes direct, but a lot of it was sold through what was then called rack jobbers or distributors. A lot of those really don't exist anymore, but we would sell directly to the retailers, and we would bypass all that because we couldn't afford to have too many people involved in that transaction process because of the massive television advertising we were doing.
Okay. Did you have any competition early on?
We did. We had a few companies that tried to emulate what we were doing, but nobody really lasted. Of the independents really lasted of a long time. There was a company called Ronco was out for a little while, and there was a couple of other companies. I can't recall who they were at this point in time, but they didn't last, you know, too many years, though.
Okay. So in hindsight, okay, now we're with the benefit of many, many years of hindsight. A lot of us collectors can trace the compilation albums. There were, in the 80s, there were now that's what I call music, which was big in England starting in 1983, 84, and they've taken off to CDs. Time Life and Rhino pretty much own the field in terms of compilations. But if you trace backwards in history, up till about 83, it was all KTEL. KTEL with some imitators.
Yeah, up until 1984, it was all KTEL. KTEL, you know, really started long before that. And so the Now series, which was really a evolution of KTEL in the UK, because KTEL was very, very successful in the UK with many, many top 10, you know, number one albums. And the record companies who we licensed music from decided they could, rather than license it to us, they would do it themselves. And so, you know, 10 years later, they wound up with the Now series, and they brought that into the U.S., you know, subsequent to that. But previous to that, we really started our music business way ahead of that in the compilation business.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a listener, an aspiring listener, sent me a list of questions that he found out you were going to be on the show, and he wanted to make sure I got to these.
I will try to answer if I can.
Let's. What was it like to work with Mr. Philip Kives?
Philip Kives.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He is an interesting man. He happens to be my uncle.
Oh.
And he is an intuitive marketer. So a lot of times he may not know why it was right or wrong, but intuitively he knew what was right to do, what was wrong to do. And he's been immensely successful, you know, financially over the years, still is very active in business today, and has, you know, enjoyed, you know, a very successful career.
Early on, how many people, like around the time that you put out the first couple of records in 1971, 72, how many people were at KTEL?
Boy, that's hard to recall, but probably 100, perhaps, in the various countries that we operated in the early 70s.
Oh, so tell me how, walk me through how a compilation would find its way from the source master tapes from the record company onto the metal tools you use to press these things, to the artwork, to some of the various configurations that you need for the different countries.
Well, every country actually created its own product. So what we sold in the United States didn't sell in Canada, didn't sell in England, because the rights were all had to be separated, except for our very first album, which we brought in from Australia to the United Kingdom without rights, just to see if it would sell. Got into all kinds of trouble, and then went out and licensed it and went out to sell a bunch of them.
Okay.
But what we would do is, obviously, first of all, you'd have to license the rights, in which case, that preceding that, we'd have our A&R people would put together track list concepts. We'd all agree on the concept, whatever, if it was teen, if it was love, it was rock, country, mm-hmm. novelty, a lot of different kinds of concepts, single albums, double albums. We'd have our A&R group would come up with the track listings, and they would know the kinds of things that were licensable and which weren't.
By track listings, is that things that were on the charts at the time or about to be released?
They were probably on the charts already.
Okay.
So if it had not been released, we probably wouldn't have requested. We wouldn't have known about it.
Oh, okay. Okay. So stuff that was out on the charts. Did your A&R team come up with a little wish list of songs they could get?
Sure. If we needed 15 songs, we may request 20 songs.
Okay.
Or whatever. And we also knew that certain songs were just not licensable. And the Eagles, you know, the Rolling Stones, Beatles,
sure.
Barbra Streisand, you know, there were a number of artists, Bread, America. Couldn't get those.
Okay.
But there were a group of artists that we knew that were licensable. And so we go after those. And we always have our wish list. We go after people we weren't sure about. And we would send them written proposals of what we were willing to, you know, pay them for the use of their rights. By good luck, our perhaps we worked with an attorney in New York that was very influential in the music business. He was a lot of times back in the early 70s, he represented three parties to the same deal, us, the artist, and the label. So we were able to get songs that we may not otherwise have been able to get. He turned out to be probably the most powerful attorney in the music business many years later. So we would get the rights to that. We would then would also have to clear the publishing simultaneously to that. We would get the master tapes in from the...
Wait, hang on, let me back up a little second. Publishing, that's the rights that go to the songwriters, right?
That is the rights that go to the publisher and the songwriter.
Okay.
That is correct. So there's two sides to an album. One is the individual who sang the song and his record company, and the other one is the person who wrote the song and his publisher. So those are two separate, distinct rights that you have to clear one, you know, for selling and reproducing albums. And so we'd have to clear, you know, both of those rights. And we have people that are involved in that clearance, you know, legal process as mm-hmm. well. We'd have the albums would, we'd request the master tapes in. While all that was going on, we would be writing and producing a television commercial and producing an album jacket. Hopefully it was all going to come together at the same time. And we would then send the master tapes individually to a mastering studio who would have to create, in those days was a very complicated process, it didn't always work, to create a master tape of the whole album. And because we had quite a few minutes of songs, so they had to be very careful about this. And in the vinyl days, if the grooves got too shallow, your needle would skip out of it.
Yep.
So the whole mastering process was a very important thing. So we'd master it, have the album jackets produced, shipped it to the facility, and those albums will then get shipped out to our various distribution centers for reshipment to retailers across the country.
Nice. Were they sold in record stores, or was it everywhere but record stores?
It was, in the early days, it was mainly mass merchandise type outlets like a Woolworths and Woolco, which doesn't exist anymore, Montgomery Ward's, which doesn't exist anymore. we never sold Walmart because they wanted to discount the albums, so we just left them off of our people we called on. Kmart happened to be a very big user of our records. We would, in fact, had done so well at Kmart that we would say we have five albums for a release in September. Here are their names and here are their product numbers. Don't know what's going to be on them yet, but give us a purchase order. And they would write a giant purchase order without knowing even what the album was, just on trust that we would produce an album that would sell in their stores.
That's great. That's the good kind of repeat business. How often did you release albums?
All throughout the year. Major releases were major television releases. We did, obviously, pre-Christmas. We did, in January, we did releases. So, you know, different times of the year. There's probably half a dozen different major releases. And as the years went on, we probably added more and more releases, and then we started adding secondary, you know, budget-type releases
okay.
as well.
So as a kid, it would be maybe every 2 months I would look forward to something new from KTEL on the show?
Well, it would be primarily, the big ones would all be in the pre-Christmas period. So okay. we might release half a dozen albums there. We'd all work towards, you know, doing all this. It would be one big onslaught of television advertising, shipping, and us calling every store in the country and getting store counts to see how many units they'd sold the day before and if they wanted a reorder, and we'd ship products right into them.
Nice.
Can't do that today, but...
Well, yeah, it's a very different world nowadays. I'm going to play... I brought in a handful of songs that I wanted to play because they actually meant something to me and some of the records that I brought in. And you at home, if you're listening at home, I'm Ron Boogie Monster Gerber, as I am every week here on Crap from the Past. We're talking with Mickey Elfenbein, who was at KTEL for 27 years, which is amazing, from 1969 to 1996. So if there's something you want to know about KTEL, why don't you go to the Crap from the Past page on Facebook? If you want to post a little question there, I'd be happy to ask Mickey some stuff. Some of the songs I brought in, this is nice. I was talking with you about the album Super Bad from like 71. There were some Isaac Hayes stuff on there, and you said really good seller.
Big seller.
Big seller?
Big seller. Great album.
And it spawned a sequel, Super Bad Is Back, which didn't do as well. But there was a song off Super Bad Is Back that I'd never heard before, and I probably still wouldn't have heard if I didn't have the album. So what I did tonight is, before we came in, I dubbed the record onto the hard drive, and I'm going to play it from my laptop here. This is a group I actually know nothing about called Mandrill, and a song called Fence Walk. It's a really catchy song that I wouldn't have known except for one of your albums. So here it is, from Super Bad Is Back on Crap from the Past. I should do something about that. Off in our own little worlds here. A song I'd never heard before from Mandrill called Fence Walk, and one that turned up on Super Bad Is Back from somewhere around 1973. Good funky stuff. If you listen to the actual... So that's taken from an album that had probably 7 or 8 songs on a side, maybe 9 songs crammed onto an album side. I'm going to assume that you used the shortest possible versions of the 45 versions, or even did some editing yourselves to cut them down so that they'd all fit on one side?
Yeah, we would use the 45s, and obviously the spacing between them was pretty short between the songs.
Yeah.
And so they were the 45. We didn't use long versions.
No. Did you do your own in-house edits on some songs?
No. It all went to a professional mastering studio to do all that kind of thing. We didn't do that in-house at all.
Who did you use back then?
That's a darn good question. I do not recall.
That's okay. That's the kind of detail, you know, it's been 30 plus years. Did they have license to shorten things or do some early fades? Or
I don't think we really had to do that. I think that we used the entire song that was provided to us by the label. I don't think we made any changes like that.
Okay. And in general, the pressings, if you from an audiophile point of view, there's pretty much no bass on them because there's no way you could do that and fit that many songs on a side. So in order to keep the needle in the groove, you dial the bass back a little bit and cram the grooves closer together.
Some of that, and what we had obviously a lot of songs, when the song track listing, you know, became less, obviously that went away, and then of course it was 8-track and cassette, and then CDs, and of course that world changed, right?
When did you do? You remember around what time you started introducing cassettes and 8-tracks?
We would have been an early user of those. So whenever we were probably one of the first companies in the market offering those kinds of things. We were one of the first companies in the United States that sold CDs, I think.
Yeah, early on. I'm going to address another question here. Whose idea was it to include many lesser-known tracks along with the hits on many of the compilations? And it sounds like, well, let me use that as a springboard. It would have been easy to license everything that was in, you know, top 10 hit or extremely big hit bound. But there were a lot of songs over the years that grazed the bottom of the top 40, you know, that song that peaked at number 30 or something like that. Was it a conscious decision to use stuff that you knew wasn't going to be giant sellers, or was that just an artifact of getting the best bang for your buck in terms of songs?
It was a byproduct of the rights acquisition process. If you remember that some artists really were unlicensable, so if an artist was unlicensable, we would go after the artists that were licensable. So the byproduct of that is that some of the tracks wound up being not, you know, in the, you know, a top 10 track. So, but there was certainly the preponderance of the songs were top 10 songs.
Did you, and I assume I'm all over the place because the mind is racing tonight. I know over in England, your albums would routinely make the album charts and do very well over there.
Yeah, throughout Europe, actually, in England, and Germany, we had top 10 song, top 10 albums, and in Holland and Austria and Finland, we always had, you know, big albums all throughout Europe.
And I assume that once you got the routine down, it was consistent where album comes out, album makes charts, and it's sort of the expected outcome?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, when there were the big TV albums, the big push albums always did pretty well for us, you know, in the major territories in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Here in the U.S., they didn't chart in the Billboard charts.
We didn't want them to chart.
Oh.
The reason we didn't want them to chart was we really wanted to be under the radar. The less the major record knew about how well we were doing, the better off we would be able to license songs going forward.
Really? Were you?
But in Europe, we were unable to keep them off the charts.
Okay, that's really interesting. So how much of... if let's say you license a track from Sire Records, just to pick a record company at random, how...
Seymour Stein owned that company.
Oh, I picked a good example. Let's say Hocus Pocus by Focus from 73, which happened to be on Sire. I was just trying to think of some song that was on Sire. Let's say you put it on one of your albums sold. How much information did you feed back to the folks at Sire?
The only thing he got back was his royalty reports. He would know what we sold because he'd see all the royalty reports and get his, you know, payments that way. So, you know, if an album could have sold 100,000, could have sold, you know, a million units, he'd be able to see those royalty reports.
And would there be a check that goes along with it, I would assume?
I would assume so, yes. Otherwise, we wouldn't be getting another song from him.
So when you license tracks from the record companies, the check goes to the record company. I assume a portion of that goes to the artists and the songwriter?
The record company usually had a deal with the artist, and generally it was a share. So if they got $100, they'd keep $50 and pass on $50. If they got $100,000, they'd keep $50,000, pass on $50,000. The publishers generally had a 50-50 arrangement with their writers as well, but of course, for every deal, there was there could have been all kinds of other arrangements between the artists and the labels as well. So, but in some cases, we actually worked with the artist's label and we paid them direct. We did a lot of deals with Elton John's own label, and we would pay him, you know, for worldwide use. We give him like $75,000 a song as an advance against the use of that song for worldwide use.
Wow. And that's, and so that Elton John would be featured very prominently on the album, I would assume.
Well, and it deserved to be because it was a big song, because most of the Elton John songs in the 70s were huge tracks.
Absolutely. But that would be sort of the pride and joy one that gets its own little video clip in the TV ad?
If it warranted, but most Elton John tracks did warrant.
Okay.
So we would feature the songs that were the hit songs. The television commercials were sort of in the same kind of style, if you would have watched them carefully. It had the same kind of opening and the same kind of relationship from one to another, how we featured songs, how we mentioned songs, how much time was spent in each song, the kind of words we used with each song, the closing. It was an opening. It was a demonstration of the music and a close. Go buy the record.
Yeah. Did you always have the song titles and the artists scroll up the screen?
No, they went all different directions.
Oh, okay.
You know, sometimes they scrolled up, sometimes they crossed, sometimes they popped on, sometimes they ran out of ideas of how to get those names on there after a while.
Nice. How did artists feel about having their songs on your records?
There was most of the independent artists who we've heard of, who we may have talked to many years later, said when they got onto a KTEL album, they knew they had made it. So for many artists, it was a big thing to be on a KTEL album, because we also feature them in a commercial and we really help them help their careers. Some artists didn't want to be on the album. They were making so much money that, you know, what could they do with an extra $20,000? It meant nothing to them.
What kind of, do you remember some artists that you tried to get that you couldn't? Well, there's the, like, Beatles and Rolling Stones.
Yeah, sure. Those are the artists, I don't know any of their songs either. I somehow just blanked out all those songs. We never got a Madonna track. We never got an Eagles track. Mm-hmm. We never got, you know, Rolling Stones, you know, America, Bread, Barbra Streisand. And you know, those are the kind of artists that we just never were able to license.
It's interesting about, I guess, Bread was big enough to tell Elektra to keep their songs off the collections?
Yeah, and also Elektra was not the easiest company to deal with either. But although we did a lot of business with Warner Special Products, which represented all of the Warner Group labels, they put together a lot of albums for us. But those were some of the albums, those are some of the artists that were just unclearable. And some people just said, you know, I just don't want to do it. But most of the artists, and we were able to get most of the artists that appeared at independent labels, we were able to get because A, the label needed the money, and B, the artist, you know, enjoyed being on the album.
Did it get any easier, or was there any change in how difficult it was to put together the albums as time wore on, from like either a legal point of view or a financial point of view? Royalties went up or went down, or artists showing resistance to put their songs on the albums?
I don't know if it got more difficult. It got a lot more expensive. I mean, in some cases, the rates would go up if we wanted a... we had a Jeff and Starship track once. We licensed the artist and the master for one use in the United States. We had to pay $75,000 as an advance on that one song. That was a huge amount of money to pay for that track. I mean, who knows if we're going to be able to recoup that. So
this is really expensive.
Yeah,
were most songs that expensive?
Well, we would when we were selling big units, we would go out and guarantee between 500,000 and a million units as a guarantee. In order to make that work, we would sometimes have to release that same. So we get two uses. We'd have to release those on a second album, like this Superstar Collection, which is a double album set.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we put those out pre-Christmas was to use up those advances that we couldn't, you know, recoup on the single album. So it'd be the big artists, but we'd be using the same songs a second time in a different kind of format.
Interesting. Are you comfortable talking about some of the dollar values, since that's so far in the past, or is that something you'd rather not talk about?
Yeah, I don't mind.
I'm just curious as to how much all of this stuff costs. Since the days of pressing hundreds of thousands of copies of albums are pretty well behind us, and this is a reality that's not going to be repeated anytime soon, let's go back to, let's say, you know, 1975 or 76 or something like that, and you want to get let's pick whatever's on top there.
Okay.
And we'll use that as a talking point. Superstar Collection,
all right,
that'll do. Tell me, let's go through some of the songs, and if you just have ballpark feel for how much it costs to get something like that.
Well, this album was probably a part of a double album set, so this is the second half of a double mm-hmm. album. Let's see if we can find something that was, you know, came out all by itself at a point.
I have, there's about 100 albums sprawled out on the table here, so.
Okay, we had an album here, it's called Together, which was a love album. And started out with Peaches and Herb reunited, and Marie, I Just Fall in Love, Commodores, Three Times a Lady. I'm going to make a guess that this is the kind of album that we probably advanced about a quarter of a million units in order to get the rights to this song album. Probably paid five, six, 7 cents a song. So if there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 14, 70, probably had $200,000 tied up in the music in advance without knowing if it's ever going to sell or not.
And that's just the music. That's the music rights. That gets paid to the labels?
That's correct.
Okay. And then there's the additional expense of having somebody master it.
Well, the mastering, what, the mastering was insignificant.
Oh, it's
yeah,
compared to that?
Yeah, it was insignificant in terms of cost. What was the other big cost, of course, was the publishing. And publishing rates went from 2 cents to 3 to 4 to 5 up to 9 now, and 9 and something now. So we would negotiate those rates as well. We try to get some sort of reduced rates by once again committing to big numbers in order to get, in order to reduce rate, in order to get the margin in place. The real cost associated with this business was the fact that we sold all these products on a guaranteed sale basis. What that meant was that for if we sold an album to, or a group of albums to a retailer, and they didn't sell them, they had the right to sell them back to us, right of return, guaranteed sale.
Sell them back to you?
Well, they would never, they'd ship them back to us.
But I mean, they...
Legally, the ownership transferred to them, then transferred back to us when they shipped them back to us. So we would get 20, 25, 35% of the albums back. There was, I remember a day right after Christmas in, I don't remember the year exactly, but UPS dropped off five trailers of returns on the same day.
Was it all the same record?
No. It wasn't okay. The same. It was all kinds of different records. So we had hundreds of thousands of records in return. So a big cost of this business, which was unseen, was the fact that there was major returns, which those had to be sold off at reduced rates and sometimes below our cost.
Where did those go?
They went back to a lot of the same retailers. They would have gone into, you know, Walmarts and Kmarts and places like that.
This is when they got the little notch taken out of the corner?
Some of them did, yes.
Okay.
Some of them did. That was really distressed. That really wasn't what we were doing. But some would do that. Some of that happened to that, yes. So,
okay.
Yeah, and some of our foreign countries, you know, wound up doing that. We had a case in Italy that they put out CCR, Creedence Clearwater Revival, and it was a huge failure over there. They sold it to a cutout guy in Italy, and guess where they shipped it to? They shipped it to the United States. Now, Fantasy, which owned Creedence Clearwater Revival, never forgave us for that.
Oops.
Oops.
Yeah. How many single artist compilations did you put out?
A lot. I don't know the number. You know, and we were releasing albums all throughout the world. We operated in almost 20 countries at one time. So there were, you know, every year we had a variety of single artists. I mean, some of the biggest single artists we had when we first went into business in the United Kingdom was, we released Perry Como, double album Perry Como. Now, would you think that's going to sell?
Not here in the U.S.
But it did about a million units over there.
Wow!
And so sometimes you just don't know.
That's, what were some of the biggest sellers here in the U.S.?
Well, one of our, as an artist album, back in the early 80s, we licensed a double album from a then relatively unknown band. They had never sold more than a million units in the United States. And we went on to sell 1,400,000 units of the double album. The artist was called ABBA.
Nice. Very nice. That's the one with the black cover.
It was called ABBA Gold. I can't remember what the cover was, color cover it was. But it was a huge album for us. It did immense numbers.
That's great. Were there any unexpected or albums you expected to sell real well that didn't, or the other way around?
We always had a reasonably decent feel for, based upon the song list, the track listing, of how well it was going to do, but, you know, within a range. I mean, one fall we had 3 million unit sellers. We didn't really expect that. And that was, you know, tremendous, selling over 3 million albums in a few months. You know, I think it was the fall of 1980.
Yeah, gold. Yeah, that's a gold record for those of you playing at home. Platinum? Or is that a platinum?
Well, it's platinum. I'm not too sure what it was. But it was a lot of records.
A million albums is
over a million.
A lot of records.
Back in 1980, it was a lot of records. We had a rock album. We had a record called, I think, called High Energy, and another pop, you know, a disco album of some sort. So, yeah, we did a lot of albums, did a lot of units.
Yeah.
And we tried to promote them a lot of different ways. We had one album that was called Hot Nights and City Lights, and we created a dance show called Hot Lights and City Nights. And we syndicated that to TV stations across the country. What that means is that we gave them the TV show. It had half of it was with our commercials, and they sold the other half off themselves. We didn't charge them for it, but we got advertising across the country for that album.
That's nice. You guys are very creative about the revenue streams, finding different ways to make money.
Well, it was a marketing company. It was a marketing company first, product marketing company first, and trying to find the best ways, you know, to sell the products that we were selling, and. We did have very talented A&R people, you know, artists and repertoire people picking songs for us as well. But the concepts of how to sell the record, how to promote them, really were marketing oriented.
Tell me about some of the other non-record things you would sell, like those little record racks that are on the back.
Well, we had a product called Record Selector, which was developed by a fellow named Julian Gutierrez. We sold hundreds of thousands of those. The first big product that we ever sold was a product called Miracle Brush. Now, you may not know what that is, but that was back in the early 70s. It was a product that we bought in Japan, and worldwide have wound up selling, give or take, 30 million units.
Wow. That's pretty good.
We were flying in the cloth fabric from Japan, and one winter we were the biggest air freight user Northwest Airlines had in those days between Japan and the United States.
Nice. The record rack you mentioned, the record selector. For those of you playing at home, and I had one of these growing up also, there were like 20 or 30 little grooves.
24.
24? Okay. You remember it better than I do. And I remember it like it was yesterday. And you put your 45s, your albums in it, and they're all facing you. You pull down the first one, and that gently pulls down the second one, and then the third, and the fourth, and you flip all the way to the back, or you flip until there's an empty slot. And that's how you know where to put your record back so you can keep them in order.
That's right.
They worked really well for 45s. They worked not so great for albums. And there was just perfect for the 45. So I had two or three of these around the house. I don't think I have them anymore. They might be at mom's house somewhere, but it's not likely. So I should tell you, you're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis, 106.7 FM St. Paul, online at kfai.org and crapfromthepast.com. I'm Ron Boogie Monster Gerber. This show is, as always, Crap from the Past. It's like a graduate level course in pop. And this week we're talking with Mickey Elfenbein. I'm sorry, I mispronounced your name in the first couple breaks there. Elfenbein. He was with KTEL from 1969 to 1996. That's a long time, and worked very closely with the people who put together all those KTEL albums you have, all of them. So that's, yeah, basically all of them. And I assume that you at least had some input for virtually everything on the counter there, right? Everything that went out the door?
I think so. I probably approved almost I probably did approve every one of them at one point or another.
Nice.
And we, of course, released albums not only in the United States, but in Canada and Brazil and Argentina. And
did you have to sign off on those too?
Not as closely. I was, directly involved in the U.S., but the general manager of those countries reported up to me.
Okay. Nice. I'm just so happy. Thank you for coming in. This is a real treat for me. I'm just really enjoying everything we're talking about here. Even to the point where if you collect the KTEL albums, a lot of the ones in the U.S. have little codes on them. Not the part number.
It's the item number.
The item number. Thank you. And it's like TU2820. And you were saying...
So the T stands for teen, U stands for United States, and we had TC for Canada and TE for England, etc. And the number was the number for that particular series, N for novelties, C for country, etc.
Yeah, so in case you're wondering what the TU stands for, it actually means something.
Teen USA.
That's so great. And teens, all the pop stuff, the pop rock things we would have bought from way back when, all labeled with a TU. I have the... There was a novelty thing I found. I found a 45 labeled from 1972, and it had the KTEL album. It said KTEL on it, and this would have been 15, 20 years ago. Like, what the heck is this? So I brought it home, and it had three grooves on it. And apparently it was part of a board game, I don't remember what the board game was, but you roll the dice or move your parts around, and maybe you put out a record or something. And then you have to decide if it's going to be a success or not. And the way you do that is you put the needle on the record, and it had one of three grooves. And I'm going to play you what the three grooves sound like. Three intertwined grooves. So you never knew which one you were going to get. So there was an element of chance here. So you could... Oops, hang on a second. I'm queuing everything up on the laptop here. So if it went well for you, you heard this.
It's a hit, it's a hit, it's a hit, it's a hit, it's a hit.
And that's it. And then all of a sudden your needle would be in the center of the record. It's only like 10 seconds long for each of these three grooves. So if it went well for you, it's a hit. And that went really well. If it did not go so well for you...
It's a flop, it's a flop, it's a flop, it's a flop, it's a flop.
And of course... Because you can't just have good and bad. You have this one where you break even.
Break even. Break even. Break even. Break even. Break even.
What a neat thing. Now, the 45 was the same on both sides, as far as I remember. And it said KTEL. And I could trace it back to KTEL, and I didn't do any digging beyond that, except that I assume it was part of a board game. Does that ring a bell at all for you?
It is. I think it was part of a board game. It doesn't ring a big bell to me because I think it probably was a flop.
The whole album or the whole board game concept?
That board game concept, I don't think it was a big product.
So that's funny.
I remember the big ones. I don't remember the ones that didn't do so well. I don't remember that one very well.
Okay. Well, I have a rarity then. Neat.
Yes.
I don't know what the thing is called. I'm sure there'll be an aspiring listener that had one of these things out there that'll be able to tell me some more. What did you think of products like the record selector and the record vacuum? So did they get much use? How well did they sell? This is from questions from the listener.
Well, the record selector did really well. Yeah, it sold hundreds of thousands, not only in the United States, but in Canada as well. Australia were the big markets for that.
Yeah, they competitors. That's a good question. So we touched briefly on, KTEL owned the compilation world pretty much, and there were some hangers-on that had varying degrees of success, and one of them was Ronco, and that's I brought in just the Ronco Winners album, which is something I had as a kid. Same flavor as KTEL, only a little more cheaply made. You got the sense from the album art that they didn't try as hard, or didn't spend as much money, or didn't have as good graphic designers to put all this together. And they'd usually have some product in the bottom left, like Mr. Microphone, on this particular Ronco album. There were others. TJM was one of them. Springboard. Pickwick. There was a whole barrage of Parade out of Newark, New Jersey. Some cheapy competitors that didn't seem to last very long. Did any of these register with anybody at KTEL?
Well, Ronco, in particular, was really a gadget company. It was owned by a guy named Ronnie Popeil and Mel Corey, which became the Ronco. Ron Popeil's father was the guy who designed a product called Vegematic, an old gadget. And Ronnie Popeil really set up this company to be a gadget company. And they looked at these records as a form of gadget. They went into the business because KTEL was doing well. Ronnie Popeil went on to be a direct response marketer and has done hugely well, you know, after Ronco itself went into bankruptcy. Pickwick, what had nothing to do with Pickwick, was a major distributor located here in Minneapolis, started by the Heiliker family. And Musicland grew out of that as well. And so they weren't really in this type of businesses at all. They were doing budget, you know, type products. Big major distributor. Mm-hmm. I'm not too sure who the other people are that you mentioned. They don't really ring a bell.
They didn't. And from a collector, they're baffling looking. They look really, really, really cheap.
Yeah.
And that's usually terrible pressings. So God only knows what tapes they were using. They could have been using other records as their sources.
It's possible. Yeah. And actually, in those days, it's possible they pulled the master off another vinyl album, so the track sound was not the greatest.
That doesn't surprise me based on some of the stuff I've heard. In the 70s, 80s, all the records you put out with the KTEL name on them, they're the original artist, original hits, and that's probably a term that's from the KTEL marketing or something very close to that.
We put them out. Yeah, we said that they were the, because people sometimes were concerned that, you know, they may not have been the original mm-hmm. artist. We had a whole other series that was the original artist, but they came in and actually re-recorded. So in the 70s and 80s, we brought in hundreds and hundreds of artists who were out of contract, brought them into a studio, and they re-recorded the song they sang before, and we re-released it. They made it sound exactly as the original, but it wasn't really the real original, and those were put out in a whole different kind of series, and that's still owned by KTEL. They have thousands of those songs that we had put together, bringing those artists in one at a time.
Most of that stuff under the Dominion record label, right?
It's now called KTEL. Yeah, it was called the Dominion record label. That's correct.
Yeah. So if you see stuff on Dominion, just know that it's probably re-recordings of the originals.
That's exactly right.
The in particular, the Chubby Checker came in and re-recorded his stuff at KTEL in like somewhere around 1975. I remember reading, and those recordings are very they're highly regarded. He did a really good job with the re-records.
Chubby Checker made more money from KTEL than he ever made from his original label, by far.
Huh.
He made way more. There's not even a comparison of the amount of the difference between between the two. His songs are still being distributed by KTEL.
Yeah, all the original stuff on, I guess it was Abco? I don't remember.
Abco, that's right.
Yeah, didn't,
He never got paid.
They never paid him.
Or hardly ever paid him. Or they paid him. They kept two for themselves and paid him one. But he made way more money than he'd ever made in his original record deal with the KTEL releases. KTEL released that album and his songs many different ways. Licensed his songs into major television commercials, which are worth a lot of money. Some of those fees are like $50,000 for major television commercials. And, of course, it was split with him as well. So he made a ton of money and did a lot better with KTEL than he ever did on his original label. Many artists actually did better on their re-records with us than they did with the original label because they weren't getting paid.
Do you remember some others?
Boy, there's hundreds of different, the Diamonds re-recorded.
Oh, so it's 50s era.
It was 50s, 60s. 70s into the early 80s where the bulk of those artists are. Actually, there's a fellow in the office named Steve Wilson. He's the expert in all of those. He knows every song in that whole catalog. He knows who the drummer is, when it's recorded, who the producer was, and everything about those songs.
Wow. There was I noticed the re-records extended up through the late 70s, early 80s, like songs like More, More, More by the Andrea True Connection and 8675309 Jenny by Tommy Two-Tone. That's like from 77, 82, that time frame. I noticed those re-recordings also ended up on some of the Dominion CDs that I found over the years. Would an artist like Andrea True reproach you, or would it go in the other direction?
No, we had a team in Nashville that's all they did is they contacted our artists that were out of contract and would fly them in. They would have their charts ready to go, and they would record their songs and be gone in a day. And we don't record the hits.
Yeah.
So we recorded thousands of songs that were top 10 hits.
Okay, so the bands, or the studio musicians, did their best to recreate the sound for the most part.
Right, yeah.
And so it's just one day in and out.
It could have been one day. It could have been more than one day. Okay. But it was done. It was done quickly. I mean, the charts were all done, so they didn't have to be doing that. And they knew how they sang it originally, and they've been singing the same song, every night for their whole career. So they certainly could do the song.
And it's very interesting to me that those make some good money for the artists.
Yeah, some of those artists have done very well, really very well.
That's nice. I hadn't thought of it in terms of benefiting the artist. It's always. For the music collectors, it's always tough to encounter one of these re-recordings when you expect the original version of the hit and whatnot. And for radio broadcasters, we want to stay pretty much to the hit versions.
Absolutely.
But it hadn't occurred to me that you're actually making some money for the artists. I had always assumed that they were re-recorded because it was too expensive to get the rights to the original hit. In the context of I want to put out a compilation album. I want the song 8675309, but I don't want to pay Columbia Records or whoever owns the rights to it. It's cheaper just for me to bring in the artist for a day and re-record it from scratch.
Well,
it sounds like that's not quite right.
No, if the artist was still signed to a label, you couldn't re-record him. Or if the artist was still in his re-recording restriction period, you couldn't record him. But if the artist was out of contract and wasn't making any money and still could sing, and we would approach him, we would bring him in, Pat Boone, all kinds of different artists that had, you know, big hit singles.
Yeah, and if you want to know just how many songs are in this Dominion catalog, it's thousands. The last time I checked the KTEL website, there was a place where I could just go and do searches and whatnot, and thousands of songs in this database.
There are thousands.
Tremendous. So it's re-recordings of virtually everything you'd want to hear. Well, no Beatles and
no,
stuff.
No, it's basically most of the artists that had not had limited number of hits. I mean, it wasn't the real big artists aren't in there. You're not going to see, you know, once again, you're not going to see the Eagles in there.
Yeah, but... yeah, interesting stuff. That's KTEL.com, I would assume. Well, Google can find it. Just type in KTEL.
That's KTEL.com.
I want to play another song. And this one's interesting in that, according to the people on the Steve Hoffman audiophile website board, I'm a participant in that. It's for audiophiles, and they're really hardcore, scary collectors. They know more about this stuff than most people want to. And apparently... when KTEL put out an album containing the song Valley Girl by Frank and Moon Zappa in 1982, it was longer than any other version that had come out on any Frank Zappa record or subsequent CDs. The 45 faded about a minute, minute and a half early, and the album, it faded a little bit and then tracked into the next song on the album, so you never got to hear the end of the song. When KTEL put out the song Valley Girl on the album Just for Laughs, which I dubbed earlier this evening, it extends about 10 seconds longer than any other known recording, which I think is pretty cool. And so in honor of that, and since we're talking about KTEL tonight, I'm going to play you that song. This is Valley Girl from Frank and Moon Zappa on Crap from the Past.
Valley Girl, she's a valley girl. Valley Girl, she's a valley girl. Hold her by, for sure, she's a valley girl in a clothing store. Hold her by, for sure, she's a...
Like, oh my God!
Valley Girl.
Like, totally.
Valley Girl.
Encino's, like, so bitchin'.
Valley Girl.
There's, like, the Galleria. Shoe stores. I like love going into like clothing stores and stuff. I like buy the neatest mini skirts and stuff. It's like so bitchin' because like everybody's like super, super nice. It's like so bitchin'. Like,
on Ventura, there you go. She just wants some bitchin' clothes. Tosses her head and fits her hair. She got a whole bunch of nothing in there.
Anyway, he goes, are you into S&M? I go, oh, right. Could you, like, just picture me in, like, a leather teddy? Yeah, right. Hurt me, hurt me. I'm sure, no way. He was, like, freaking me out. He called me a beastie. That's, like, he's totally blitzed. He goes, like, bag your face, I'm sure. I am so sure he's like so gross. Like, he sort of like plays with all his rings and he like flirts with all the guys in the class. It's like totally disgusting. I'm like so sure. It's like, barf me out, gag me with a spoon.
That idea to cross her mind has something to do with where to find a pair of jeans to fit her butt and where to get her toenails cut.
So, like, I go into this like salon place, you know, and I wanted like to get my toenails done, and the lady like goes, oh my God, your toenails are like so grody. It was like really embarrassing. She's like, oh my God, like bag those toenails. I'm like, sure. She goes, I don't know if I can handle this, you know. I was like really embarrassed. Clean the cat box. I am sure that's like gross. penis, so it's okay. So, like, I don't know. I'm, like, freaking out, totally. Oh, my God. Hi, I have to go to the orthodontist. I'm getting my braces off of you. But I have to wear a retainer. That's going to be really, like, a total bummer. I'm freaking out. I'm sure. Like, those things that, like, stick in your mouth are so gross. You gotta get saliva all over them. But, like, I don't know. It's gonna be cool, you know. I'll buy some, like, see my smile. It'll be, like, really cool. Except my, like, teeth are, like, too small. But no biggie. So awesome. It's, like, tubular, you know. Well, I'm not, like, really ugly or anything. It's just, like, I don't know. You know me. I'm, like, into the, like, the clean stuff, like, Pac-Man and, like, I don't know, like, my mother, like, makes me do the dishes. It's, like, so gross. Like, all this stuff, like, sticks to the plate. It's, like, somebody else's food, you know? It's, like, grody, grody to the max, I'm sure. It's, like, really nauseating. Like, bark out, gag me with a spoon. Gross. I am sure. Totally.
And apparently, they tell me that that ending that you just heard right there, unavailable anywhere else. And I don't have the full Frank Zappa album that came from, but that there, Valley Girl, which was a top 40 hit in 1982, Frank and his daughter Moon Unit Zappa, from the vinyl album Just for Laughs, put out on KTEL somewhere around 1982, something like that. You said not a big seller?
I don't think it was a big seller, no.
Not ringing a bell.
Not ringing a big bell.
I'm so impressed that you can remember, you can look through this stack of albums and go, oh, big seller, eh, this didn't do so well. And
well, I remember the big sellers, and the ones I don't remember, I assume, aren't big sellers.
What would how many units would a big seller sell and a small seller sell?
Well, if an album sold over 1 million units in the United States, that was obviously a very strong album. If it was a double album that sold over 500,000 units, that would be a big seller as well for us. And those would be very successful for us.
And at the low end, stuff that didn't turn out as well?
No, we could sell 50, 100,000, 150,000. The real problem with those was not that the fact that we sold an insignificant number of units. The fact was that we probably shipped heavier and got a lot of returns that sat in our warehouse that really ate away at our net income.
Where was the warehouse?
Well, the warehouse, in the primary warehouse from 1975 to 1986 was on KTEL Drive in Minnetonka.
That's a western, southwestern suburb of the Twin Cities. It's maybe 8-10 miles from here.
Yeah, we moved in there. We were the second building on that street, and I told the owner of the property that we're buying it from, it was originally called Burton Boulevard, and I asked the owner, whose middle name happened to be Burton, I said, I'll buy the land, but I want to change the name to KTEL. He said, fine. He was a good guy to work with.
Yeah, nice. And there is still a KTEL Drive.
There is still
it's
a KTEL.
It's just a
there.
Little street off Shady Oak Road in the southwest corner of town here. You can go there. I used to drive by there all the time because my job was pretty close to there. That's so nice. We're talking with Mickey Elfenbein, who was with KTEL. Well, KTEL, the company, it wasn't just records. There was other stuff as well. But we, in terms of the record albums that my listeners would know, he was there from 1969 to 1996. And you said you had a good story about Peru, was it Brazil?
It's Brazil. We had a business in Brazil. Brazil happened to be, and this was back in the 70s, rather violent country. And we at one time had moved into a new warehouse. I happened to be down there visiting our general manager, and our office was up kind of the side of the warehouse building, and the warehouse had some glass windows at the top of it, and apparently in the middle of the afternoon, one of the girls runs up and says, there's a gun battle going on in the warehouse. And what had happened was these bandits came across the roof, and they pointed their guns down at the girls packing records. They started to scream. We had forearm guards on, always had armed guards on, and they started shooting at each other through the roof. Remember, I brought home a spent shell from there as a souvenir.
That's terrible.
It is terrible. Yeah, we had some bad things happen in Brazil too.
Nobody was hurt.
Nobody was hurt in that thing.
Okay, then that's fine.
Nobody was hurt that
Jeez.
Time.
Jeez, oh did, that time.
Yeah, we had another. Oh. Yeah, we had another incident where we did have some people that got hurt. So
that's not cool at all.
No, it wasn't. We had some people who were packing. We were doing a quarter end audit, in our warehouse was not in a very good part of the city there. And we had some bandits broke in, and we had the Arthur Andersen Auditors were there, and they beat up the Arthur Andersen Auditors. Eventually, the police got them, though.
All right. So, but still, not cool. That's things you don't think about here in the U.S.
No, you
Minnetonka is kind of sleepy.
Well, by comparison.
Comparison with most places, there's not much
going on. Rio is a pretty beautiful city. The beach is Copacabana, Ipanema, beautiful beaches there. So
it's different.
Much different.
Very different.
Much different.
KTEL was based here. If you're wondering, KTEL, the company, was based here in a suburb of the Twin Cities, the whole time, wasn't it?
The worldwide headquarters for KTEL was in Minneapolis. However, the company really started in Canada.
Oh.
And the majority of owners lived in Canada.
Okay. I always think of it as being that address at the bottom of the KTEL albums.
Well, that's the U.S. That was the U.S. address, and the worldwide legal headquarters for the United for KTEL was in the United States. However, a lot of it was a lot of the financial affairs were run out of our office in Winnipeg.
Okay, I wanted to talk about Hooked on Classics.
Hooked on Classics.
From our point of view, from the radio listener's point of view, you heard the Beatles Beatles imitation medley from the Stars on 45 in 1981. And that touched off a gigantic medley craze that lasted about 18 months throughout 1981 and 82. The other big hit, well, the Stars on 45 did just fine, but they only had one really big hit with that Beatles medley. And there were some smaller singles and some other albums that went along with it. The other big seller was Hooked on Classics.
Hooked on Classics was developed by our office in the United Kingdom. We sold it over there very, very successfully. Sold hundreds of thousands of units in the UK. We eventually licensed it to RCA in the United States. RCA, in the initial run, went on to sell over 3 million units with a top 10 single. At one point, we actually flew in the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, who performed at halftime at the Orange Bowl as part of the promotion to this whole thing. And it spawned a whole bunch of additional albums we did. Hooked on Swing with Larry Elgar, also licensed to RCA United States initially. That sold more than a million units.
Hooked on Swing, the 45 actually hit the top 40. So Larry Elgar had himself a top 40 hit after 50 years of recording.
Right, and that was another big. And then after that, we did Hooked on just about everything we could think of, and we did Hooked on Classics 2, 3, 4. We did Hooked on Swing. We
what
did
other
Hooked
ones
on,
do I have?
Hooked on 60s. We did Hooked on Baroque. Hooked, we did every kind of concept you could probably think of.
One of them, I think, is called Hooked on Themes, which I thought was, out of ideas at that point.
We were probably reaching by that point in time. Yeah. So Can't Stop the Classics. We did all kinds of different different kinds of Hooked on concepts.
Here on the show, for years on end, I would do the god-awful medley of the week, and I would play the Hooked on Classics or the cheap knockoffs of the Hooked on Classics, because there were some. And I got up to about 300 medleys, and then I just gave up on the feature, because there's only so much of that I can take. So, look over there. It's Simon Husbands, host of True Brit here on KFAI.
Ron, how are you tonight?
I am ecstatic.
This is just a spectacular meeting of the minds here. I feel I am not worthy to be in the same studio space as you two gentlemen.
Well, you are most worthy because you grew up in the same time frame that I did, except in England.
I did. KTEL was just, it went all over the world. I mean, it was a phenomenon. And I remember sitting there watching adverts on TV for KTEL and thinking, what is this KTEL? Very odd. And then when I first arrived in Minnesota, I was driving through Hopkins and I saw this street and it said KTEL Drive. And I thought to myself, that's got to be the same thing. I said, why have we got a street called KTEL Drive? So, Mickey, you probably know the answer to that. Why do we have a street called KTEL Drive?
I just mentioned that.
Yeah, we just discussed
you came in. I do apologize.
Based right here. Yeah, it's the very same KTEL. Exactly. So over in England, they would release the compilation albums much like they did here with the TV advertisements to promote them?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And, they were, we have, I don't know if you've ever heard of them, the Top of the Pops albums in the UK. Are you familiar with those?
Yes, sure.
They were kind of, I guess, your competitors?
Sort of, yeah.
They had the same kind of prestige, I suppose, as KTEL. KTEL was like this big, in-your-face, buy this record, it's going to change your life. And, of course, it never actually did do quite that, but it was still fabulous stuff to see those adverts. So it's just happy days, happy days.
Yeah. And well, throughout Europe, I mean, in Germany we did them in German, and in Holland we did them in Dutch, and in Finland we were in Finnish, and in, you know, in Brazil we were in Portuguese.
So did you did you ever see yourself as being like high art?
I don't think we thought of that, no.
Because I think in many ways you were. I mean, those were just so kind of out there and in-your-face adverts that people remember them, you know? And in the same way that you might remember going to see the Mona Lisa or something like that, people do. It just sticks with them.
Well, our objective in those television commercials was not to win an award for having the best commercial. It was to drive somebody in the store to buy a record.
Exactly. And it worked.
It worked very well.
I know it did.
Simon, when you were growing up, did you buy any of the KTEL albums?
I must have. I can't remember specifically which ones I had. Like, I don't have an encyclopedic memory for stuff like you do.
Well, all of mine are right there.
I know. I can see. Good heavens. That's a huge stack of stuff.
And that's only about two-thirds. I just couldn't carry anymore.
I know. Amazing. But, you know, I sold all my albums just before I emigrated to the U.S., so I'm afraid they went the way of many of my other favorite albums. But yeah, I mean, everybody I knew had KTEL stuff. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was a huge, huge thing.
Yeah, we started in the UK in approximately 1972 with our first album.
Wow, that was the same year that Roxy Music had For Your Pleasure. So, you know, that was when I was really starting to get into music. So that's when KTEL first caught my eye, when that stuff started happening, you know. And it was like, okay, this is affordable music, you know. This is something here that is a real bargain. So, yeah, very definitely at the start of my musical interest, it was definitely there. So, yeah, KTEL played a big part. Mickey, you played a part in my childhood.
I hope it was a positive part.
It was, absolutely.
There's really no downside to this. If nothing else, you're exposed to songs that you wouldn't have heard. Like, you and I know the song Hot Child in the City by mm-hmm. Nick Gilder. Mm-hmm. But thanks to one of the KTEL albums, I know the follow-up called Here Comes the Night. I'm out on a limb here. I think there was a follow-up single that I never would have heard because it didn't get any airplay. Thanks to one of your records. There's dozens and dozens of examples, if I thumb through here, of stuff that I'd never heard before. I played one of them earlier on tonight.
I think we were one of the things that, you know, a lot of people that were buying our records, all the young people that were buying our records, were they were between that cassette, that singles and full album stage. And they moved from singles to our albums and onto our compilations onto full albums.
Yeah.
Did a lot of you have kids or teenagers that were active customers that you would sort of rely on now and then for research?
Back in the early 70s? No.
No.
No. We had an A&R team back then. But back by mid 80s, actually, my son was in the business and he was doing the rap albums. I don't know where he got the ideas for it, but he was doing all the rap compilations, and by the mid-90s, he was really running music compilation business for us.
I wanted to talk a little bit about what happened in around 84 and sort of the restructuring of the company.
So really what happened was 1980-ish, the company was doing, you know, remarkably well. We're doing more than $100 million in sales. Profits were, you know...
Hang on a second. Let me just stop you there. You were doing how much?
It was over $100 million in sales.
$100 million. Now, that's worldwide, right?
That was worldwide. That was in the early 80s. A lot of that came out of the United States, England, and Germany. Those were the big, you know, big territories for us.
$100 million albums.
It's a lot of records.
No, dollars of sales.
Oh, dollars of sales. Well, even so, yeah. Even back in those days, what were they retailing for?
$3-4,
okay,
I think.
So that's still an awful lot of records.
It was huge. I mean, we were number one all the time in the UK and yeah. In the United States. We didn't get charted, of course, but we always had albums that would have been in the top 10 over here as well. But we were very successful, and we got involved in a multiple of other kinds of non-related business. We got involved in the oil and gas business. We got involved in real estate development as interest rates went from, you know, 6% to 23%, and we got involved in a direct response company. All that. We used up all the available cash, and in 1983 or 84, when we were at our peak of about $175 million in sales, the U.S. bank foreclosed on its loan and forced the company into bankruptcy. So we went into the bankruptcy at about $175 million
wow.
of sales. We came out of it after, you know, closing down a variety of companies around the world at about $15 million in sales. By 1996, when I'd left, in that 10 years later, we were back at about 100 million in sales.
Interesting.
There was a tough grind, tough road from 1985 onwards to rebuild the business, not only in the United States, but, you know, in some of our foreign territories as well.
Yeah, and they're foreign, and you got a new batch of foreign competition starting in 84 with the Now That's What I Call Musics, and yes. This Is Music, and Out Now, and there are a bunch of others all in the similar flavor for the KTEL stuff. So suddenly,
did the two of you touch on licensing issues at all?
A little bit.
I'm always interested in, you know, the problems that you have dealing with different record labels and artists maybe that don't want their stuff to be released on compilation albums. Did you have many difficulties specifically with record labels or any specific labels in particular?
It really was the problem was with specific artists. Some artists were just, you know, unlicensable. We had good relationships with almost all of the record labels. You know, the majors, you know, Warner Group, you know, Sony, you know, RCA, all of the majors. We had, you know, good relationships with. Sometimes there were, you know, labels within them that, you know, were not, you know, our fans. But if it made financial sense to them and if the artist wasn't opposed, we were able to license, you know, most things. But the really big artists were just unlicensable.
So why is that? Just because they didn't want to play the game or just because they didn't like KTEL's reputation? Or
I think they just thought they were too big. They didn't need the money, as I said before. You know, what are they going to do with an extra $20,000? They just didn't need the money. And it was something they just didn't want to do. Although a lot of younger artists, when we called on them to license to be on our albums, thought, hey, we finally made it. We are on a KTEL album.
Yippee!
Yeah, the folks on... like, for example, in the group, Toby Bo would have been thrilled that My Angel Baby ended up on an album. So, Simon, you seem overwhelmed by the gigantic pile of records before you.
It's a huge stack, that's for sure.
I should point out, Mickey, those are stuff I just had. It's not stuff I actively obtained for your coming in. It's just stuff I had under V for various artists.
It's rather amazing to see all those.
Does it take you back, Mickey?
It does. I remember a lot of them. I remember, you know, stories about individuals which sold well, which didn't sell well.
Why don't Simon and I will talk amongst ourselves while you...
Well, we got the Seals and... We have Seals and Crofts here. We did an album, Seals and Crofts. This is an album that, you know, was a very mediocre album, didn't sell, you know, really well.
Did they like it?
You know, they were kind of a little aloof to the whole thing. I'm not sure what they thought about it. I flew out there to... do the commercial with those guys, but I'm not sure what they thought of it. Rainbow, this is a, you know, a kind of a soft rock album, did, you know, big business with Billy Preston, Diane Warwick, Nicolette Larson, so Commodores.
Yes,
we had a deal with Motown. We had all their songs at one point in time. We did a label deal with them.
Huh.
Right On, this is an album. Nobody ever liked this album jacket. I can see now why back then I...
Well, let me look at that. I don't want to look at that.
It's very much in the flavor of the Top of the Pops, if I'm not mistaken.
It is absolutely.
Simon, would you like to describe?
I will. It says, okay, so it's got the KTEL logo and the KTEL name, and then it says Right On in that kind of, what year was this, Mickey?
What song?
It's in the back, probably in the mid...
76. Okay, so that kind of, the font is very 76, and it's got an attractive blonde with a kind of a pouty mouth, like a Marilyn Monroe, and one of those shirts that she's tied up above her belly button, looking at the camera and giving it a thumbs up for some reason. Not quite sure why. Not sure what she's saying to me.
She's basically saying, hey, because that would have been rather right time frame
Fonzie,
for all that.
So it's, Thin Lizzy, Diana Ross, Electric Light Orchestra, Paul Anka, Eric Carmen, The Miracles, ABBA, War, Pilot, fantastic stuff.
Yeah, 75.
So that album did, you know, fair. Here's an album called Together, which was a was kind of a love hits album. This one actually did very well for us, you know, Peaches and Herb, Anne Murray, Commodores, things like that did really well. I like this album jacket as well, kind of told the story. We tried to tell stories with the album jackets that related to what's going to be on the album as well.
Did you have an in-house design crew that put together all of these?
Initially, we didn't. Actually, our purchasing guy did a lot of the design work in the early years with an artist. And then later on, we actually had full-time, you know, in-house design people that actually did, you know, desktop design work.
The early 70s records are iconic looking. they you'd recognize the art. Things like Superbad and Superbad Is Back. You'd know it if you saw it. Or like Hit Explosion, like Simon is holding up there.
I love that. You see, it tells you everything about the record. Hit Explosion. It's just fabulous stuff.
We didn't try to get too creative. We tried to get a story, you know, soul told very quickly.
Wow, look at that. Flock of Seagulls, Space Age Love Song, Eye of the Tiger, Survivor, Mickey by Tony Basil, The Go-Go's, Steve Miller Band, Joan Jett, Pat Benatar, and Rod Stewart all together on the same album entitled Hit Explosion. I love it.
It's great.
Here was a big album called Stars, 1977. Some big acts on this, 10cc, Hall & Oates. We had almost all the Hall & Oates tracks. Hall & Oates were in a management group that was run by a guy named Tommy Mottola, who went on to become the president of Sony. But his attorney was a guy named Alan Grubman, who happened to be our attorney. We got all their songs.
Cool.
Yeah, that's good to know people.
It certainly helped. KC and the Sunshine Band. We all got all the KC songs as well. This is a group out of a label out of in Florida, run by a fellow named Henry Stone, who is still active. 25 Polka Greats. This was our first album. I think we talked about this before already.
Wow.
And let's. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask how many albums did K-Tel release? Do you know?
I don't know, but I would guess in excess of 1,000.
In what kind of time frame? In
25 years.
25 years. Wow.
Maybe more than 2,000.
Wow.
And sold probably, I lost track, probably between 50 and 100 million albums, probably.
Wow.
That's an insane number of records.
It's insane.
It's actually quite difficult to collect all the K-Tel albums. I was on a binge for a while, for a good couple of years, and there was actually a website run by some woman named Lisa the K-Tel chick, and she had pictures of all the K-Tel stuff online where you could search her little database, and it was beautiful, and I think K-Tel shut it down. This would have been like 2002, 2003. This is after you left. But K-Tel didn't like the fact that Lisa, the K-Tel chick, was putting up pictures of their records, and they gave her the business.
Look at this. I like this one, too. The Hot Ones. Fabulous stuff. Look at that. Dave Mason. Dave Mason on the same album as England Down, John Ford Coley, Yvonne Elliman, Gene Cotton, and Smokey.
Smokey?
Fabulous stuff. Living Next Door to Alice.
Is that an American album?
This one is, American.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Do you remember that one? Living Next Door to Alice? Yeah.
Not a big hit here.
Yeah. Andrew Gold, Thank You for Being a Friend.
Yay.
Fabulous. The Hot Ones.
Did pretty well.
I love it.
That album did pretty well.
I love that you can just remember that off the top of your
head. Here was a big one. Obviously, I know this was a big one called High Energy. That was a big, this was another million seller with Heart of Glass, Knock of Wood, I Will Survive, Shake the Groove Thing.
Yeah, 1979. Mickey brought in an actual gold record.
Wow.
I can't imagine many gold records have passed through the KFAI doors.
Wow, but we should get a photo of this.
We
this
really should.
Fabulous.
You're the one with the iPhone, right? You're going to have to take pictures of all this
we'll
stuff.
Yeah, we'll do it. Wonderful.
I don't know if I've ever actually seen or touched
two
gold records.
Well, I couldn't. We had many of them.
Did
how blasé.
How many did they sort of get divvied up among the executives there?
No, they're with the chairman of the company with the at his office currently, most of them.
Okay.
Wow.
We have some in my office.
That's fabulous. Look at that.
That look suits you, Simon. Holding a gold record in your hands.
Yes.
I like that. Yeah, we're good. Definitely going to need pictures of this before we go home tonight.
I know, I deserve it. So, Mickey, what was the best-selling K-Tel release?
I think Hooked on Classics.
Hooked on Classics.
Yeah, Hooked on Classics by itself sold between 5, I don't know the number, but between 5 and 10 million units.
Wow. That first album. And I should point out, and you'd mentioned it before, that was one of the few original recordings that K-Tel actively produced.
Yeah, that K-Tel did produce, and it is one of the few that sold that kind of quantity. We did produce other kind of products as well, but that was one of the few that would turn into a hit album.
Yeah, and big, really big hit. It was part of the medley thing that we talked about earlier on in the show.
Oh, yeah.
Nice. Should I play another song?
Yes, do.
And this one, It's interesting to me. This one's from an album called Neon Nights. Do we happen to have that one there? That would be under N.
Are they all in alphabetical
order?
Well,
they were at one point before I took them out of the boxes.
I've been mixing them up and shuffling them and so, who knows what.
Under N neon. For neon. If you don't see it, then... Hey, High Energy, that's the one that went gold. That's right it. There.
One of the ones.
Nice. Well, the one that's right there. Well, in any case, there's some really good stuff on it. There's a Rick James song, song by War. But the one that caught my eye was a song by Prince, a local guy here in town called Controversy. And it's surprising to me that the song ended up on a national compilation because Controversy was not a real big hit when it came out.
I've not heard of that one. Which album was that
from? 1981.
Okay.
It was after I Want to Be Your Lover, before 1999. And it's a great song, no doubt, but it kind of made me scratch my head a little bit and think, like, the A&R group that you were working with here had some local feelers out, because you people certainly would have known who Prince was in 1981, more so than the rest of the country.
Sure, of course.
And the fact that this song found its way onto one of your albums without really being a national hit at all was a wonderful thing. And this album would have exposed this song to many, many, many people who would never have heard it otherwise.
So, Mickey, what you were doing is you were offering up a public service for music lovers the world over. So I suppose I should really thank you on behalf of the world.
Yeah. And for those of you who were introduced to Prince from the album Neon Nights, this is for you. Controversy on Crap from the Past.
Controversy.
I should turn on the mics there. Once again, I lost track of the actual time there. You're hearing the scratchiness of the record. I played it off the album. All the music you've heard tonight from my collection of KTEL records, that there from the album Neon Nights. It was out of controversy from Prince, and it was out around the same time as Super Freak by Rick James, and stylistically fit right in with it, but I was just so intrigued that controversy wasn't a hit at the time, at least in the pop world, and Super Freak was, and you introduced a lot of people to that song with that particular album. The Neon Nights album was wonderful. There were a couple of R&B dancey albums that KTEL put out that were extraordinary. Some really terrific stuff on them. I don't know who your A&R guys were at the time in 81, 82, 83, but some really terrific stuff found its way onto those albums.
Yeah, we had a team in Los Angeles at that time that was doing the A&R for those kinds of things, and so that was one of the themes, and we had people that really understood all, you know, facets of music.
Yeah, and put together its iconic, I don't use the word often, very much iconic compilation albums, and really set the template for now that's what I call music, and Rhino and Time Life and a lot of the others that came afterwards, and the bread and butter. It was all started by KTEL and you guys and your team. So I want to thank you for coming in tonight, Mickey Elfenbein. It's been wonderful having you here. I'm all giggly.
Thanks for having me.
It's just been so great because you see the pile of albums that I've accumulated over the years. I'm quite a fan and an unironic, unapologetic KTEL fan. I just love these records to death and the context in which they came out and just what they represent, a little slice of my childhood there. And even if it, and even not in a non-nostalgic way, I just love the cover art. I love everything about them. So it's been a pleasure having you here and having you talk about them.
Well, thanks.
Yeah. For those of you listening, you're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, 106.7 FM, St. Paul, online at kfai.org and crapfromthepast.com. I have to do this thingy here, and then we'll do some underwriting stuff, and then Simon will come in with True Brit. Does that all sound good to you? All right, then. Thanks for listening. I'll be back with some, you know, normal programming, which is going to seem rather mundane next week. Thanks again, Mickey. Really appreciate it.
I know you're gonna dig this.
What am I doing? No, I can't play my theme song. That's not right. Oh, so sad. Let's just try this again.
Programming on KFAI is sponsored in part by Jimmy John's Gourmet Sandwiches, located at 2037 Riverside Avenue, providing subs, clubs, and catering to the University of Minnesota, Augsburg College, and the West Bank of Minneapolis. More information is available at 612-344-4444, or online at jimmyjohns.com.
Programming is supported by Ampers and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Announcing Ampers.org, featuring music, arts, and cultural stories, including many produced by this radio station. Information and audio at Ampers.org. Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities.
And the Lord said, let there be crap.
What's with all the crap?
It's not crap.
It's Crapinfest.
I can't believe it only comes 52 times a year.
Crap from the past.
Crap from the past.
Crap from the past.
Stop. It's hammer time.
Funk, rock, Peter Gabriel singing in German, soul, old school rap, ABBA singing in Spanish, glam, hair metal, Milli Vanilli singing in English, and of course, disco.
Disco is the pop music of tomorrow.
It's all pop, and it's only on Crap from the Past.
Shake your booty.
Shake your groove thing.
Shake your rump to the funk.
There's a lot of crap on the radio, but there's only one Crap from the Past.
It's craptacular.
Worldwide at crapfromthepast.com, and Friday nights at 10:30 on KFAI.
This is WRKL New City, New York, AM 91, Rockland County's community radio station. WRKL is owned and operated by Rockland Broadcasters, who wish you a good morning. So long. Thank you.